We've got just half an hour now, and I'd like to think that what we were doing up to the break was a kind of ploughing, breaking stuff up. I'd like to think what we might briefly do now, I'd like to suggest to you four things we could be planting into what we've ploughed up as a way forward. These are just a personal selection, really, but I want to look at the language of growth a bit and suggest there are four unexpected allies that might just feed into our understanding and enable us to move into something more nuanced, more reflective, less driven, and that we might just find something of the life of the kingdom in. So I'll just throw it at you, four things, see where we go, maybe just a few minutes to gather at the end, and we'll finish promptly at 12. Four unexpected allies is the way I've talked about it. And the first of all is to do with research into the human brain. And this left brain and right brain stuff, I expect you've come across it. I know it's a lot more profound than I'm going to make it sound, but I'm good at sounding if I know what I'm talking about. So I simply won't take questions at this point. There's left brain and there's right brain. And I'm sure you know the left brain is the controlling, ordering, calculating, routine. It's essentially detached, practical, usefulness, technique, quantifiable, measurable, clock time. It's broadly speaking, that's the left brain side. Right brain is where we actually access our creativity, spontaneity, music, our lived time, the kind of kairos stuff, empathy, complexity, experience, metaphor, ambiguity, that sort of thing. Now, we need both, of course. We need both. But one of the features of... Sorry, let me just go back to this. One of the features of our own age is I think we are very left-brain driven. And quite a lot of approach to strategies can be very left-brain driven. And it may just mean that we're almost always on a kind of problem-solution line of attack on stuff. And I just don't believe human beings flourish when treated like that. So I have a deep suspicion of any strategic work that's applied to a community that's too left brain. I just don't think it works. I've been long enough in Christian ministry now, I think this is the fourth time I've been in a diocese that's been doing the big vision stuff. And it always intrigues me. The same stuff circles around because the gospel hasn't changed. Of course it has. But our context is changing. But we need the space to be reflective. And thank you for the conversations over the coffee break that were making resonances and really, really stimulating. Jonathan Sacks, the former chief rabbi, makes the point that in the Hebrew scriptures are read from right to left. They have no punctuation until the 10th century in the Christian era. No punctuation and no vowels, just all capitals. So when you stand up, you won't be asked to do this, when you stand up to read from the Hebrew scriptures as they have been for most of Jewish history, you need, he says, the big context to interpret the precise meaning. Of course you do. So you need intuition. You need to be reflective. You need to have a whole sense of the wider story to know where precise parts of the text and scripture and teaching may fit or contribute to the whole. Then Greek was the first language to be written from left to right. And Greek was the forerunner to an age of that we call the Enlightenment and the Renaissance, to scientific research, which breaks up the whole and examines minutely the constituent parts. Do you see the difference in the methodology and the way you might approach the message you're hearing? Nothing right or wrong with either of them. But actually, I think we've gone so far into the Greek reading and the minutiae and the scientific objective stuff, we've lost something of the bigger picture and the capacity to reflect from the whole. That's just almost by the by, that we need a bigger picture at the moment to hold the way we do our questions. But a lot of our society today is obsessed with techniques, strategies, and roles. We assume that's the way we're going to get the answers. I just don't believe it's true. I don't think they're irrelevant, but I'm not prepared to allow them to be the driver. We seek clear and almost literal certainty. We follow rigid rules. There's still an almost obsession with binary thinking. This or that, yes or no, remain or leave. It's just we've reduced complex discussions that we really do need for our future and our flourishing to ghastly simple opposites. It's not only undemocratic, it doesn't work. We don't function that way, and we just get gridlocked. That's the first one. The unexpected ally is bringing together the extraordinary gift and capacity of human reflection and analysis. I'm just tossing this in. You can't expect me, please, to explain it any further, but take it where it connects and where it helps. Left and right brain. Okay, this is John Kay. John Kay is one of the leading economists in this country. He has his own website full of interesting articles. He writes in the Financial Times and various other journals and things. And a few years ago, he wrote a book called Obliquity. And the whole point about his book on obliquity is that actually human beings reach their goals indirectly. And the more you try and get a straight line, the more you actually fail to meet your goals. This does link with the previous comment a little bit, but let me just show you where he goes with it and commend to you the book. He draws a contrast with loads of examples in the business world between a visionary approach to business and a profit-driven approach to business. And he locates a shift in business and economy in this country from vision to profit-making and from obliquity to direct line strategy. That shift, he says, began in the Thatcher era economically. I don't know. He's an expert, so I agree with him. Let's go where we go. He said there was a shift at that point, but actually there are other stories where you can focus what was going on. Do you know what the original Sony founding statement said about their business? We shall eliminate any undue profit making. What planet were they on at the time? Do you recognize any of that as an approach to business today? Quite extraordinary. But the more serious example, and this I'm using this to illustrate a number of other examples he gives, which he says shows a consistent strand, is that the pharmaceutical company founded by George Merck. And George Merck, in 1950, writes this: "We try never to forget that medicine is for people. It is not for profits. The profits follow, and if we've remembered that, they have never failed to appear. The better we've remembered it, the larger they have been." Do you recognize this as an economic approach in the present debate and climate? Then that's 1950. 1995, in a letter to shareholders, "Our objective is being a top 10 growth company." In 2000, Merck is totally focused on growth. And Kay simply observes, they went into decline very soon afterwards. Kay's argument is, it is not the way to profitability. Businesses actually don't flourish on a profit-driven strategy. In fact, the reverse happens. I find that extraordinary good news, but I'm not speaking as an economist at this point. I want to stress that. He gives examples from ICI, Marks and Spencer's, from the banking and the financial world, of all sorts of similar tensions where this tension between profit-driven and vision clashed, or there was a shift from the one to the other, and the effect it had long-term on the business. He says there are a number of reasons why the direct approach doesn't work as an approach to growth. And I wonder how this translates into community growth or even church growth. Firstly, reality is always more complex. A certain directness of approach presumes a certain kind of reality. You need a straightforward world to do a straightforward approach. What if the world isn't straightforward? Secondly, knowledge is always more limited. We just don't know as much as we need to know to go through the strategic approach we are tackling. And secondly, intentions and outcomes are more distant relatives than we tend to presume. So it looks as if it's worked. So, of course, the chief executive in there gets all the credit for it. Actually, Kay says it's mostly an accident. We were muddling through. We happened to have hit a happy coincidence, and it's taken off. But actually, it's nothing like the cognitive certainty that we like to think it has. Human beings flourish in reflective, indirect environments. This is a bit like the quote I gave you earlier about if you want to give people a longing for sailing in the sea, don't tell them how to make boats. That's a spin-off. That's a necessary outcome, but they will do it if they can't wait to get out there and sail. That's an oblique approach. Human beings work like that. If you want to get someone's attention, you've got to somehow get the energy going, haven't you? It's not the subject, it's actually the energy, the heart, the vision, the desire. And then you'll take them anywhere. You really will. Quite recently in the Dragon's Den, I don't know what the Dragon's Den says about this kind of approach at all, an inventor was dismissed recently for forgetting that the main purpose was to make money. You can't get anything, Kay says, more destructive than that viewpoint. Kay says, we're inclined to see history through the lives of great men, and he means men, he's used the word deliberately. That inclination blinds us to the real complexity of politics, business, and finance. So we find intentionality in design where there's only chance and improvisation, directness where there is obliquity. A lot of what works in local churches, and works is the wrong word, but you know what I'm trying to do. A lot of what actually creates life and stirs things is often almost accidental. But somehow people have caught fire with an idea or a little project. It's very rarely the main strategy, but something of perhaps the intention spins off and you catch people where their lives are actually combustible, where they will catch fire, and then it will happen. But he's right. It's often indirect. It's true for me. I don't think that's just my temperament. Do you get that? Do you see something of what he's saying? It's worth a read. It's not too technical. I'm not an economist, and it's full of stories, and it's a very interesting and thorough critique of a whole era of approach to politics and economics. But it spins over into how any community grows and flourishes. And it's usually indirect. So the unexpected ally, the second one, is obliquity and doing it sideways. Questions that do not have an answer need to be asked very slowly. It's Anne Michaels, the novelist. Questions that do not have an answer need to be asked very slowly. Now we see dimly. There are texts there in the New Testament that warn us that what is not on offer is utter clarity. And some of the most important searching and waiting and sifting we do is in the dark. Donald Winnicott was the pioneering child psychologist of our era in the 50s and 60s. Almost everything that flows from our now into our understanding of particularly child psychology began with him. And one of the tributes a colleague paid to him was his monumental capacity to contain unknowing. This is a pioneer, and the church, I can tell you because it's part of my job, we're doing pioneer ministry more and more now. And it's people going out, there's good, exciting stuff going on. But how interesting that you'd think that you are sending out a pioneer in the church. They have some sense of what they're doing and where they're going and why. Winnicott became the pioneer he became because he was able to live in places where he hadn't got a clue or recognized what was going on, and he observed and he waited and he kept vigil and he learned the questions to ask, and out of that emerged a new way of knowing. Maybe what we need more than anything in our time is a trusting theology of time. This stuff won't happen quickly. And it's not about the survival of the church anyway. We need to let go of that. But a trusting theology of time says, if we can contain the unknowing that's immense in our age, there will be discoveries. If we sit and wait and try out different questions and listen and observe, there is still meaning on offer, and it will come to us by God's grace. That's something a bit about the tension of message and depth, I think. A little bit of that going on. There are two ways of speaking about knowledge in Christian spirituality and theology. Kataphatic, the Greek word, means according to image. And what I've been trying to do today at one level, with pictures, with language, with stories, is to make something real to you and visible and say, I get that, I can see it. We use that sort of language. Yes, I've got it, that's it. That's kataphatic. That's making something knowable and graspable, and you go away feeling, I've got a hold on that, I've got a handle on it. That's kataphatic knowledge. But actually what you and I know is, when our business is God, there will come a point when you've done your preaching and your sharing and your evangelism where you know that every word and metaphor you've used has just tipped over into an abyss of unknowing, because God is mystery and you can't see him. You can't sum him up. God is no being. He's no thing. You can't just describe God. So faithfully doing kataphatic will lead you to the apophatic, which means beyond image. It's sometimes translated the negative way, but that's really unhelpful, because it's actually more positive than the kataphatic. You're going into greater mystery. It's actually your way into trying to express at all the mystery and glory that is God in the midst. I can forgive someone a bad sermon if they've actually given me a sense that they're on the edge of kataphatic and apophatic, if they're on the edge of anything they can put into words, because it's bigger and more glorious. That I can journey with, because I think I feel it in my own soul too. So there is something about, John Pritchard talks about this, the need for apophatic witness in a kataphatic age, an age that presumes the right to knowledge, the right to know, freedom of information, is going to sit with real difficulty in a gospel that says God lives in inexhaustible mystery and inexpressible light. And we can't just bounce into his presence with our concepts and definitions and philosophical treaties, because that's idolatry. Questions that do not have an answer need to be asked very slowly. And we ask it with those we're sharing with. It doesn't mean we put mission on hold while we wait. It's all in the engagement. But it's what we presume that we can tell or share. And it's what we presume they might have something to offer back. The gospel itself is oblique. It's subversive, it's unimpressive, it's inefficient, it's hard to plan for, it's slow, and it's indirect. It's the poor who go into the kingdom, and the sinners go into the kingdom ahead of all those who've shaped their whole life around this stuff. The strategic stuff just went belly up for the Pharisees. It just didn't work like that. The gospel's not available on those terms. The tiniest and the least reveal the greatest. To find life, you must lose it. To live, you must die. To be filled, you must empty yourself. To be great, you must become the slave of all. We're common clay pots with this bizarre, unexpected treasure in the midst of it all, because God chooses that it is so. In order that it may be made clear that this power doesn't belong to us, but belongs to God. It is all gift. So basically, we are faithful improvisers. There was one of the more enlightened bishops' reports on leadership had this happy phrase about being faithful improvisers in our age. I love it because it's all about obliquity, trying out stuff. But what I think it missed and what I want to suggest to you is that God too is a faithful improviser with us. He's not up there with his own strategic plan waiting for us to somehow tap in. God too is endlessly, creatively, imaginatively improvising with all that we offer and even what we don't. That's the way of grace. So it really can go anywhere, and all things are possible. And my last few thoughts, if I may, and then I hope I've just allowed a couple of minutes before the end. I wonder if you know Vincent Donovan's book, Christianity Rediscovered. Do some of you know it? Some of you, yes, a lot of you do, that's good. It was Vincent Donovan, Catholic priest in Tanzania, rejects all the traditional ways of doing mission, partly because it's very settled, school, hospital, and church, but the Maasai were thought to be the most hardened to the gospel. They weren't hardened, it's just they were nomads, so they were never in one place long enough to catch the habit of church, hospital, and school. So he simply just went and said, I want to talk about God with you. And they said, well, who can refuse to talk about God? So day after day, he journeyed to the local kraal, and this book came out of that. But the rediscovery he refers to is his own rediscovery of faith. So I want to suggest that something of what we're doing in this context is all mutual. And when we take this faith stuff and we share the journey with those outside the faith and those we're just seeking to connect with, their story and their spirit and their life in God, however ill-defined, is part of what we bring to it all. And that's exactly what he found. In the very moment he was trying to find ways of expressing faith to the Maasai who hadn't yet embraced it, it was again and again their insights and their responses that connected for him with his own faith in a new way. So he came out of it newly converted. And he describes it, this is jolly tough, and this is often missed when his book is talked about. It was an adventure, a journey of mind and of soul, a disconcerting, disturbing, shattering, humbling journey. He speaks about the pain of faith being shattered. He speaks of the agony of belief and unbelief. He said, I ached in every fiber of my being. That's something of our journey in a strange land. And it's all mutual. There are a few around out there who don't know this is what it takes. And the sheer strangeness and complexity and often destructiveness of the lifestyles and culture that now surround and drive our choices and presume to tell us our values and our meaning on the face of this earth. It's an extraordinary story if you've not come across it. But then he says this near the end, and this is a very, very quite famous quote. Do not try to call them back to where they were, and do not call them to where you are, beautiful as the place itself may seem to you. You must have the courage to go with them to a place that neither you nor they have ever been before. This is about exile again, isn't it? This is the faithful rootlessness, the willingness to journey together into something we don't yet see. Brian McLaren, I don't know where the path will lead. It's like we've come to the edge of the map and all familiar paths are behind us. But a new world is out there ahead of us. I feel this urge to find other people who are on the edge of the map too. And maybe if we travel together, we can make some new discoveries. There aren't any footprints to follow, but there's light ahead. And there's a certain beauty in it all. I've dumped quite enough on you at this point, and we've covered a lot of ground, and with your stimulating input too, there's a couple of minutes. Can we have a little bit of lollipop time? Is there anything you would be frustrated you haven't said as you travel away from this morning's meeting before we stop? Just quite briefly now, please. Just anything anyone would like to reflect on? Thank you.
Our parish recently went on St Cuthbert's Way.
Oh.
It started off as just a walk along a line, but for everybody that went, including my husband, who is not a church attender but has a faith, it was a massive... It was a real journey for all of us, spiritually as well as with feet aching and everything. And everybody did it at their own pace.
Yes.
But we all just grew together. It was incredible.
Thank you. Anyone else? That's absolutely fine.
They're asking questions slowly. They're asking questions slowly.
Ah. It's just kind of...
Very exciting, very energising. Is there anything that you would highlight from church history that would give us courage to say that Christians have faced these kind of societal shifts and rediscovered Christianity?
It's an interesting question, that. I did say early on we've not been here before, but I think it's probably not true that we want to claim our problems, our questions are unique. 150 years ago, in the Victorian era, they were facing massive missional challenges. We tend to think of the Victorians as having sitting at the high point. Actually, they, between 1840 and 1860, they spent the modern equivalent of £4 billion on church buildings around the country. And they also created the lay reader ministry, started 150 years ago last year. And reader ministry was interesting because there was a vicar in Bethnal Green, for example, who, because of the Industrial Revolution and patterns of work, slum estates had spread all around his parish, which of course was landed gentry stuff at the time. He was doing 800 weddings a year, 700 funerals a year, 600 baptisms a year. He was working round the clock on Christmas Day doing this stuff. Just him. Ministry was only clergy in those days. No one else did anything. They weren't allowed to. It's too dangerous to let the lay people near it. The readers were created for this, and they were part of the brief of readers, because they were still barely allowed to do anything in church. They were to read to the poor. Isn't that interesting? That's what the word reader means in when you hear it. It's not about sitting on a sofa with a nice book. It's taking out and reading aloud to people who otherwise won't hear the story. And I say to the reader, I'm warden of readers in Gloucester Diocese, it's part of my job. And I say to those readers, we've got 180 of them, I said, your job is to be out there and out loud. Because we are now, once again, in a literate age. And unless someone reads to them, they won't hear it and they'll have no capacity to enter into this discussion and journey at all. So now the dilemma of that Victorian missionary era is that all the churches we're now paying a fortune to prop up were built then. I'm afraid that's just one person's mission strategy is the next generation's millstone. I don't know, we can't do much about that, but it was honourable and it was brave and it was pioneering and it was an attempt to engage where no engaging was happening. So that's a very quick response. We probably ought to stop. Yeah? Oh, sorry, there's one more.
One more.
So
you have two more then.
Just two more and then we'll stop.
I just wanted quickly to say the religious orders have basically faced this challenge ever since Vatican II. How they've had to change the way they live out their lives and attract people into the religious life. And I think perhaps that's what you've said today is basically what they've been doing for so many years now to try and become more relevant to the modern society.
Okay. Thank you. One here. And then I think we've got to stop.
Thank you so much. And as recently dislodged from. Has it gone off?
That's all right. No, you're okay.
Just wondering if you would consider relocating to the north to show us how to do it.
I don't think we can go there at the moment. That's a continuing conversation, isn't it? Yeah. I'm ducking. Thank you so much for engaging with us. It's been so stimulating. I'm very grateful for the wisdom and stories you've shared and for your invitation.
Well, it's my great duty to thank you. Sorry, I've got a microphone.
Oh,
I hate to do this to you, but I'm afraid I found this incredibly relevant. I really do think you've addressed what you've given us is a real foundation in which many of the talks we've had fit into that context. It's one of the most insightful speakers we've had, and I really want to thank you. And you said, have you ever had an experience of change? This morning. Thank you.
Thank you.